In re the estate of Sobolewski. I assume we have another lawyer out in the hall. He is here, okay. Then he, I imagine we'll see the people leaving and to come in. So I think their yellow light goes on at 1 minute because mm-hmm. that's when ours goes on. But I will let them know. All right, come on, people. Good morning. We're here in the matter of the estate of Sobolewski. Counsel, while you are getting settled, I'll remind you that you each have 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellants, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your time is going to be indicated by lights at the podium, but when the yellow light comes on, you will have only 1 minute remaining. Usually it's a 5 minute. For whatever reason today, it has a mind of its own, and it wants to just give you a 1 minute warning, so be mindful of that. It is also important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Anita. Okay, just a second.
Yep, that's fine.
Please the court, Your Honor. My name is Steve Nelson. I represent the Frank Sobolewski heirs in a case that's been consolidated. Two cases were tried. Frank and Renee Sobolewski died 16 days apart from each other. Renee Sobolewski's estate was probate was started first. Frank Sobolewski's estate was started second. These cases were consolidated for trial. Judge Larson, senior judge, heard this case, and we tried both of them together at the same time. However, he did separate findings for each case. Subsequent to filing the appeal, this court, on its own motion, consolidated the cases. So I'm not going to distinguish between the two. The facts are intertwined, and I'm simply going to address the facts as we see them. Frank Sobolewski was a World War II veteran. He enlisted in 1941. He was singled out because of his skill and stamina to become a member of the 101 Airborne Group. He was also one of the original 140 members of Easy Company. I think that most of us in the present vernacular recognize some of those names. He was dropped behind enemy lines. He fought toward Germany, fought through Bastogne. Tremendous battle there, outnumbered 5-1. Survived, fought into Germany, was part of the Liberation Company that liberated one of the concentration camps, Dachau, and was the first company as a master sergeant to reach the Eagle's Nest. All of this is World War II history, but it does create a man that I've known most of my life since I was 14 years old. This case involves Renee Sobolewski, and I can tell you that Frank fell in love with Renee Sobolewski. They were married in 1973. That's about the time I returned into Niagara Falls with a brand new law license. And they were married until 1997, when they divorced. They were divorced for a number of 11 years, but then they rekindled their relationship, and they got married again in 2008.
And the heart of this case, and you know, we've read your briefs and
yes,
appreciate the factual background and recognize this is an intensely fact-driven case. But the heart of the dispute really is whether the prenup, I always call them prenup agreements, that they signed before their second marriage, their remarriage, whether that prevented, as a matter of law, Renee Sobolewski from changing her will to gift the lake cabin to her children and not to Frank's. That's the heart of this dispute.
It is the heart of the issue, and it was my next sentence in my
okay
play.
And what is it, what language in the prenup should we rely on that point?
Well, I think the language of the prenup, and the prenup was not contested by either party. Both parties adopted the prenup. Neither one of them had issues with it. Judge Larson accepted the prenup. He, too, liked the word prenup as opposed to antenuptial, although the statute hasn't been changed. It still uses that word. But the language of the prenup simply is that these parties drafted this agreement not so much for their own benefit. They were well along in years. They had their own retirements. Renee was going to school at the time, had become a teacher. Frank had retirement from the paper mill. But they drafted this document because they wanted to take care of their heirs. Renee wanted to make sure that her heirs got a fair shot and a fair division of assets. And Frank, too, wanted his heirs, his three boys and daughter, to get a fair share of the assets. That's what the prenup is really all about. And unfortunately, because lawyers didn't draft the prenup, but I have to say, in spite of that, the plan was pretty well made. I believe the prenup, and I think we accept that Renee drafted the prenup. There's only one paragraph in there that involves the heirs, and it indicates that this prenup is for the benefit of the parties, division of their assets, and their heirs, which is why we're all here today. It's because we have both sets of heirs that have had this contest. Now,
but isn't it striking that even though this property, the Gold Shores property, had been declared to be premarital property at the time of the first dissolution, basically, that when they got back together, Frank signed a quitclaim deed deeding the property to her?
He did. Actually, the deed to the property occurred back in October 10th of 2011. That wasn't the deed to the Gold Shores property. That was the deed to the Park Avenue property.
Correct.
Now,
I'm sorry.
Directing the deed to the Gold Shores property, that came shortly after the divorce in 1997.
And it was never deeded back to him. I mean, after the parties remarried, they did not share legal ownership of Golden Shores, did they?
Well, Frank had a life estate. Frank was 12 years older than Renee. he retained a life estate to the property. I don't believe...
But a life estate isn't something you can pass on to others, is it? I mean, it's by definition, your interest in property is during your life.
I think you can pass it on to others, but the ownership of whoever you pass it on to is going to end at your death.
Okay, yes, but I'm just saying it wouldn't, once he died in this case, without having passed his life estate on, it's done.
That's a fact, but I don't think Frank understood the nuances of a life estate. I think he believed that he had ownership of that property because the testimony in the trials was that Frank had told these guys that this shoreland property was going to be theirs. And I think that when he found out that he didn't have anything to will, now his will specifically says that he's giving that property to his boys. His will that he wrote in January of 2012 specifically says, my Gold Shores property is going to go to my sons. Paraphrasing. So he believed that he had something to give. Found out he didn't. I don't think he found out he didn't have anything to give until after Renee died, and they were in my office, actually, and he was described and he was informed about what a life estate was all about. And I think that's the first he knew that his interest died with him. However, what he had was shared property. And the prenup talks about shared property. I mean, I don't know if there's a legal definition of shared property. It doesn't fall into the categories of joint tenancy with right of survivorships, tenancy in common, co-ownership, none of this. But it's shared property, and the prenup talks of shared property. And I have a hard time bringing myself to admit that if you have a life estate with total use of that property, even though somebody else has a remainder interest, that it's not shared property. It's shared property that was shared during the divorce, it was shared during the marriage, and I'm sure that the costs of the taxes and the maintenance and all the other costs to own property was paid out of marital funds.
So I just want to make sure I understand your reading of the prenup. So I'm looking under property, paragraph one, that talks about the separate property owned by each party at the execution. And so you're saying that would not, I want to make sure I'm following, that wouldn't include the Gold Shores property because that was shared property because they both had an interest.
Well, it was shared property. I don't know what shared property really is. Well,
at least it's not separate property. That's your interpretation,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. It's okay. Not separate because he had the absolute right of use and occupancy of that property. And he was, for all practical purposes, the only person that did use or occupy this property. The cabin was a cabin, but it was rather remote, basic. And Renee, I think, liked her situation a little bit more plush than that. But
shared property in a real estate situation where there's no fee ownership by one party doesn't create fee ownership, does it?
I don't think that the prenup requires fee ownership. It doesn't say that. It addresses shared property. And I think that opens the door to the fact that if there's evidence that this property was shared, it's hard for me to understand that it wouldn't be, because a life estate does have more rights to that property in the use and occupancy than the remainder interest. Now,
During the lifetime.
Renee died. Frank continued with his life estate. Didn't terminate with Renee. Now, Renee's will, January 5th, 2012, gave the Gold Shores property to the Sobolewski boys.
Frank's children, yes.
And they had a duty, receiving that, to pay off the mortgage on the Park Avenue property. Park Avenue was a nice home, located in a nice area, had beautiful view down the river, Rainy River, which creates the border between the United States and Canada, and beautiful sunsets. I'm very familiar with that property. And she loved it. She wanted this property to go to her daughters, and appropriately so. So her will in January of 2012 specifically said that she was going to devise that property to the Sobolewski, Frank Sobolewski's heirs. Frank's will said about the same thing. He was going to devise that property to his heirs. There's consideration for that in the quitclaim deed that was signed on October 10th of 2011, because Renee didn't want any chance that her daughters would not receive that nice Park Avenue property. So she put them right on the deed. Frank signed the deed, the daughters signed the deed. Well, the daughters didn't sign the deed. Daughters signed a mortgage later, but they had joint tenancy with right of survivorship. So that was a gift, and that was consideration for the wills that came 2 months later.
Why didn't the wills just reflect then that they couldn't be amended without consent of the other?
Well, they weren't contract to make a wills. The prenup kind of did that anyway. I mean, if lawyers had been involved, we would have had totally different documents here. The lawyers weren't involved in any of these transactions and none of these documents. But the wills were based on the consideration that Frank was giving up any claim he had to that Park Avenue property. It wasn't going to go to his kids. It wasn't going to be part of his estate. And he signed those documents.
At the time the prenup was drafted, I see Provision 16 that talks about entitlements granted each to the other according to the wills of each party. But what wills are we talking about?
We don't know. We don't know the wills. But we do know that in December of 2011, Renee prepared a list of disposition of personal property, which is usually attached to an existing will. Most of the wills that I've seen and have drafted, which isn't a great deal of them, but they usually have a paragraph that says, I may, by list, signed in my handwriting, give items of personal property to specific devisees. And so there was a will out there when she did this. This was not a will in and of itself, because it didn't deal with the real estate, didn't deal with anything else. Dealt only with items of personal property, her jewelry, and some other things, some of the artifacts of the war, some of the things that she had. And we have that document, but we don't have any other wills. So Judge Larson found a plan, and the plan was simply stated, the girls would get the Park Avenue property because it was on a deed with better survivorship. The boys would get the Gold Shores property, but the Gold Shores property was worth more than the Park Avenue property. I think the numbers were the Park Avenue property were about $170,000 plus or minus. The mortgage on the property, Park Avenue property, at the time these transactions were taking place was about $65,000. It was reduced to about $54,000 at the time of their death. And so the Gold Shores property, they were estimating the value of that. I have to say that on Rainy Lake, we've had tremendous upswing in value in the last 5 years. So when these wills were prepared in 2012, Renee's system of equalizing these transactions was that she was going to have the boys pay off the mortgage on the Park Avenue property. So both the boys would get the Gold Shores property without a mortgage, and the girls would get the Park Avenue property without a mortgage, and then the personal property would be divided according to their instructions.
Counsel, your time has expired. You'll have to pick that up on your 5 minutes for rebuttal, okay?
All right.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. The first thing I would like to state is that Mr. Nelson loses sight of the fact that arguments of attorneys are not evidence. And I would say that more than half of the alleged facts that he's argued to you here today are nowhere received as evidence in the trial. You've got the trial transcripts. You can look at them. Nowhere was there any evidence of value of the Gold Shores property. We know because of an exhibit from the earlier divorce that the Gold Shores property at that time is indicated that it's worth $77,000. We have no testimony by anybody as to what the value of that Gold Shores property was at the date of Renee Sobolewski's death, at the date of Frank Sobolewski's death, or at the date of trial. There is no evidence of who paid the various expenses with Gold Shores or with Park Avenue. There is no evidence. Mr. Nelson makes this argument about what's usually in these prenups, and he makes arguments about the view at Park Avenue and how beautiful it was, and how there's nothing in the record about any of that. You can't come here to a court of appeals. The appeal is based upon the facts and evidence.
Yeah. Well, I think counsel made some legal arguments as well, and I'd like to turn you to the antenuptial agreement and the provision for property. And I think he argued that the separate property owned by each party, that the Gold Shores, in fact, was not separate property because Frank retained a life estate and so, in fact, did have ownership in that property at the time of the remarriage.
And I would agree that Frank had ownership in it, but it was not a shared ownership. And I would call Your Honor's attention to, I think it was the one of the early questions you asked Mr. Nelson, and looking at the prenup, what's the important provisions in the prenup that the court should concentrate on? And I would indicate that the property section is very clear. Number three, and I quote, unless a particular piece of property is explicitly documented as being owned by both parties, the following types of property will not be deemed as shared property. A, any property owned by a party at the date of execution of this agreement. And when this agreement was executed, the remainder fee was owned by Renee Sobolewski. Frank Sobolewski had a life estate. That had been that way ever since their divorce, I believe, in 1997.
And you'd say that's not shared legal ownership.
It's not. It is not. It is not shared property. It is the separate. And again, Judge Larson found that the fee remainder that Renee Sobolewski had was her separate property. The life estate was the separate property of Frank, and that never changed. It never changed from 1997 until about 20 years later when the deaths occurred. So it's, and nowhere in this prenup, it doesn't refer to specific property. It doesn't talk about Gold Shores. It doesn't talk about Park Avenue. It doesn't talk about the Shorewood property.
I don't think they owned Park Avenue when they...
They did not, but they did own, Renee owned Shorewood Drive from the time of, you know, when their divorce was. And at the time, it wasn't, this was a negotiated divorce settlement. And she took on all the debt, the evidence is in there, through the divorce documents from earlier, that she took on about $180,000 in debt. She received the real estate except the life estate that Frank got. Those were separate assets. They were separate when they were divorced. They remained separate when they got married. I mean, if they weren't shared property for the 11 years they were divorced, how would they all of a sudden become shared property when they remarried? If we were somehow changing the nature of that ownership, they would have referred to it in the prenuptial agreement. And it was never referred to. It never changed. And their marriage didn't turn what was separate property into shared property. During those 11 years of the divorce, even after their marriage, she had no rights during Frank's lifetime to go there. And there's no evidence, despite what Mr. Nelson purports to the court. There's nothing in the trial about how much time Frank spent at the cabin, what Renee liked, did she like nicer things, who paid the expenses. There's no evidence to that. And the same is with all of this you know, he starts out trying to create sympathy for this war hero. And nobody questions that Frank was a war hero. But all these details that Mr. Nelson starts with today, those aren't in the record. That's not evidence. Yeah. And I think, again, in his briefs, he tries to bring in emotion, makes all kinds of claims against Renee about being deceitful and all these different things.
I mean, the prenup does, it does talk about, you know, entitlements granted each to the other and to the wills and are to be adhered to. There's duties of good faith that are expressed in the, I mean, so the fact that Renee decided to amend the wills, the will that she signed up presumably along with Frank a year earlier without telling him, I mean, that does sort of raise questions about good faith, and doesn't that make her motivation relevant?
And again, there isn't any evidence in the trial transcripts as to what those motivations were, but...
wasn't there evidence that she told a daughter, don't tell anybody about this, or something like that?
Yes, there was evidence that she feared for her life from the sons of her husband, yes. There was evidence to that effect. And again, I think, and there is evidence in the transcript that we don't know who prepared this. It was surmised that it wasn't done by a lawyer, either the prenup or the wills. And again, I think... And Mr. Nelson hasn't argued it here today, but in some of his earlier briefing with the trial court, he was arguing that these wills that they executed on the same day in January of 2012 were somehow together and similar, and that should somehow prevent there being later changes. Those wills weren't the same. Mr. Sobolewski's will made no reference with regard to Gold Shores. His will from 2012 made no mention of paying off the mortgage on the Park Avenue property, made no mention of the Park Avenue property whatsoever, whereas Renee's will had a whole paragraph related to the Park Avenue property and did indicate at that time that it was her desire that the heirs of Frank Sobolewski pay off that mortgage on the Park Avenue property that had been deeded jointly to the children, her daughters, and her and Frank.
Didn't that make sense? Because they were sort of like mirrors of each other, because Frank's will, again, was giving the lake cabin to his heirs, right? I mean, so there was some symmetry between the wills executed the same day, whether they were mirror wills or not.
They were similar, I admit, Your Honor, but they were different in significant aspects and different with regards to the real property, which is really the question that we're dealing with here today. They also make the argument in his briefs that there was some, there was plan to make things equal. There's no evidence anywhere that there was any effort to equalize what Renee Sobolewski's daughters got and what Frank Sobolewski's children got. He also makes the argument in his brief that the Sobolewski boys are left with nothing. Nothing could be further from the truth. The evidence at trial was that Tim Sobolewski, either as personal representative of the estate or as a surviving joint tenant on some bank accounts, received close to $300,000. So we don't have a situation where everything's, you know, going to one group of children and nothing going to the other. It's simply not true. And again, it's arguments of facts that are created. They're not in evidence. There's no way to know if they're even true or not. The other, and Mr. Nelson never got to it, and I don't get a chance to reply, but the second issue he raises, and again he didn't talk about it, was whether or not there should be damages awarded to his client because of this breach of the prenup. Well, that was never an issue. That was never presented to the trial court. It's not properly before this court. There is a lawsuit pending, and I think the natural result of if there was determined to be a breach of the prenup, then they probably are entitled to damages. If there's not a breach, then they wouldn't be. Judge Larson determined there wasn't a breach of the prenup. This was a legal codicil. That's apparently not being challenged in this appeal. And the only question is, does the prenup somehow prevent Renee Sobolewski from changing her will? Judge Larson determined no, and I would argue to the court that that's a factual determination based upon the evidence that he heard. The next question is
his findings. So you're saying we should go beyond the four corners of the prenup to make that decision?
Well, I don't think you're restricted to the language of the prenup. I think other evidence, but there isn't any evidence at the trial. I mean, Mr. Nelson purports all kinds of arguments based upon facts that he alleges, but there's no evidence of those alleged facts in the trial transcript. It just didn't occur. The last item whether or not the Frank Sobolewski estate should be responsible for paying off the mortgage on the Park Avenue property. Judge Larson found that they should. The reason for that was it was joint property. There was, I don't remember the exact year, but a few years before the death, there was a deed to the three daughters of Renee, and she and Frank retained a life estate. Then a couple years later, there was a refinance. And so Border State Bank, and there's evidence of this in the trial, Molly Bragg comes to the three daughters of Renee, says you need to sign this mortgage because you're on the deed, but you're not going to be responsible for in any way for the payment of the mortgage. And that's in there. It was received in evidence. Judge Larson determined that that was valid. When Renee died, the only one that was still left on that note that owed the bank was Frank. And we submit that his determination that Frank's estate should pay the balance of that mortgage is correct.
Why shouldn't the balance be paid out of the proceeds of sale of that property?
Well, Your Honor, there was a sale of the property. Those funds have actually been and again, this wasn't evidence at the trial because that issue really didn't come up at the trial. In order to accomplish that sale, the mortgage had to be paid. The question is, does the Frank Sobolewski estate have to repay what was paid? And again, from the time of death until we got to court, there is evidence that the Sobolewski girls kept the mortgage payments current, and whereas the Sobolewski boys contributed nothing. And again, in Judge Larson, in his order, indicated that they should be repaid for that portion that they paid. You know, another interesting factor is that they're arguing that Renee shouldn't have been able to change her will because of this plan, and it had to be fair to everybody. Well, between the time Renee died and when he took his life 16 days later, he went in and changed the nature of the ownership. He severed the joint tenancy on the Park Avenue property with the three girls. I think it's strange that...
How could he do that if he only had a life estate?
He had a life estate, but he had joint tenancy. They had joint tenancy on the deed. He had a life estate. On the Park Avenue property, he didn't just have a life estate.
He also had
the Gold Shores, he had a life estate. On the Park Avenue property, there originally were five joint owners. Renee dies, there's four joint owners. Before Frank dies, he goes to Mr. Nelson's office, severs the joint tenancy, so now his estate gets a quarter of that. Had that not occurred, the entire value would have gone to Renee's estate.
He had the right to live there as a joint tenant, but not as a specific life estate.
There was no designation of a life estate on the Park Avenue property, Your Honor, just joint tenants. And as a joint tenant, he did have the right to sever that joint tenancy, which he did.
Well, then that makes sense, but... Yeah.
He was the one living there. The girls weren't living there, and he severed it while he was living there. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Nelson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, Judge Larson was troubled by this case. He tried to get it resolved by agreement. In fact, when we were arguing in our motion for a new trial, and this is the only time that I've recalled that this happened, he said, I'm going to delay my decision and I want you, meaning the parties, mediate again. And when you tell me you've mediated, then I'll decide the case. He said, I'm troubled by some things. And the things that he said he was troubled by was exactly what we've been discussing here. And if you look at this as a will case, there's no question. You can amend a will. Just like a kid could pick up a rock and throw it through a window. He can do it. He's physically capable of doing it. He can do it. Breaks the window. It's not legal, and there should be consequences. But Renee could do the will. The will met the minimal requirements of having witness, et cetera, notarized. But
it did. It wasn't self-proven, though, apparently, like the first wills.
I think it was intended to be. There was a notary. There were two witnesses and a notary. There wasn't the self-proving language. There wasn't any language on the page. And that's what the question is. It didn't identify itself as an amendment, didn't identify it as a change. The original will was left totally intact. The page that this second page was supposed to replace wasn't torn, it wasn't drawn through, it wasn't obliterated. There wasn't any indication that Renee ever intended to amend that will. The only thing is this codicil was found. We call it a codicil. It was just a redone, a retyped second page, and it was different. And that is the only basis that Judge Larson had to say must be an amendment. If you read the statute, he had grounds to say that. But how could the codicil have prevented this? It couldn't prevent it unless you redid or renegotiated the antenuptial agreement. Now, they could have renegotiated. It had provisions that allowed them to go back and change it if they were in agreement. They could have changed it so that the whole scope of that would be modified. But if they did that, they'd have to go back to the Kenny principles. And I rely on the Kramer case that was most recent Supreme Court case, 920 Northwest 2nd, 617, 2018. And what they said is that what you have here is really the statutory safe ground. But you also have the common law safe ground that applies in a case such as this. And so they go through the four Kenny principles, and they said that these have to be considered by the court to determine whether it was full knowledge, full disclosure, both parties had adequate consideration, the deed for the Park Avenue house was consideration for the device of the Gold Shores property, and an opportunity to consult with counsel, which means that they have to understand the agreement. And if you look at that, they could change the prenup. But if they don't change the prenup controls the wills. And if the prenup controls the wills, Renee's will's out. Now, she can do it. But what are we going to do to make things right? Damages? Yes, we could be paid damages. We could disregard the parent amendment as being contractually in violation of the prenup. These are issues that really haven't been decided very well in this court. Can a prenup control the wills and an estate disposition? And what's the consequences if you don't? Do you have to go to court and try to get, if both parties are alive, an injunction? All these things are issues that are kind of open in my research. So, lastly, Sobolewski girls received a gift of the Park Avenue property, but the gift was only the net value. and the net value of that home was subject to the mortgage. They knew that. They agreed to it when they took the gift. They went down and they signed another mortgage so the bank would have security. They said, we did not agree to pay the debt, but the house was already on the mortgage. The house paid the debt, and that's exactly how it came out when they sold it. The house paid the debt, paid the mortgage. That money should not come out of Frank Sobolewski's estate because it was part of their gift. It was an encumbrance on the gift that was originally given.
All right, counsel, your time has expired. Thank you both for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the last of the three cases scheduled for oral argument this morning. We also have three cases for non-oral consideration, but we will recess now to do those. And oh, we're actually going to stay here. You can all leave. We have a group of students here, and we're going to spend a few minutes answering any questions you might have here today. So we'll excuse the rest of the group.